There's nothing like the thrill of a last-second victory. That buzzer beater from 20 feet out. The game-winning field goal that just makes it as the clock ticks down. That great limited-time deal on a new 2017 Volkswagen at the Volkswagen Model Year End Event. We need to make room for the 2018s, so this could be your last chance to get a great deal on select 2017 Volkswagen models. Visit your nearest Volkswagen dealer for a test drive today. But hurry, because the clock is ticking and we can't call time out.
So you bought a car, and now you can't afford to buy anything else. Did you know? You don't have to be stuck paying a high interest rate on your auto loan. At Westcom, you may be able to refinance your car loan to a lower rate. Westcom is member-owned, so we have great rates, which means buying a set of wheels doesn't have to put you on the road to regret. Check out our great rates at Westcom.org. Certain restrictions and conditions may apply. Loan approval subject to credit and income evaluation.
Dad, what's your favorite part of the holidays?
Well, son, I'd have to say my favorite part of the holidays is getting zero due at signing, zero down, zero security deposit, and zero first month's payment on select Volkswagen models.
Not peppermint bark?
Oh, that chocolate minty delight doesn't come close to the joy of the Volkswagen Sign Then Drive event, where for practically just my signature, I get to drive away in my new Volkswagen Jetta.
I do love this Jetta. It's rad.
Yes, the Volkswagen dealer knows how to make the holidays special.
If only they can throw in some peppermint bark.
Anything's possible during the Sign Then Drive event, son.
Head to the Volkswagen Sign Then Drive event where you pay zero due at signing, zero down, zero security deposit, and zero first month's payment on select models. Going on now at your local Volkswagen dealer.
Lease offer excludes tax, title, license, registration options, and dealer fees. Example lease for 2016 Jetta S with manual transmission. $219 a month, 36 months, zero due at signing based on MSRP of $18,500, including destination charges and excluding other noted exclusions. Offer valid only in the U.S. Dealer sets actual price. Closed end lease offer to highly qualified customers on approved credit by Volkswagen Credit through participating dealers. Offers end January 4th, 2016. See dealer for details or contact 1-800-DRIVE-EW.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn. You tell me. You call pop. Je ne comprends pas. Je ne comprends rien.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, there's a tendency to think of givers as the chumps of the world and takers as the people who get ahead, but tonight's show will explode a lot of our beliefs on that. My guest is Wharton organizational psychologist Dr. Adam Grant, who's written a wonderful research-driven book called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. So stick with us tonight to find out how to keep from being a chump and how to give so it's the key to your success and maybe even stunning success in work and other arenas of your life. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So I love this. You don't have to be a jerk to get ahead.
That is definitely one of the conclusions of the book.
And so, you know, you interviewed a lot of people, a lot of really amazing people, and we'll get into what's a giver and a taker and a matcher, but first I'd like you to tell me a story of, basically your favorite story that you encountered while writing this about one of these very giving people.
Well, the person who stands out the most for me is a guy by the name of Adam Rifkin. As you know, he's a very shy, quiet, introverted software engineer and entrepreneur in Silicon Valley. And back in the early 90s, Adam was trying to figure out how he could use his skills to help others. So he started to see the internet as this vehicle for not just sharing information, but actually building community. And he began to build fan pages for bands that he liked to try to help them build a following. And many of those bands went nowhere, but one of them just completely took off. And within 6 months had about 1 million hits. And it was a little band you might have heard of called Green Day. So, you know, neat experience, right? This guy in his spare time makes a little website, helps make Green Day famous. So they call him up and they say, "We love your website. Can we buy it from you so we can turn it into our official fan page?" And Adam thinks about it for a little while and says, "No, I'm actually not willing to sell it." And then he gives it to them for free.
Wow. And so, I mean, this is something I see in common in your book. And now people think this is the antithesis of how my parents raised me. You've got to make a buck. And, you know, and they think that this is dumb, but it isn't dumb. How has Adam, this is sort of emblematic of how he lives, how has this affected his life?
Well, it is. And, you know, a lot of times it looks like he's making a big mistake on the face of it. You know, shortly before that actual request from Green Day, he got an email from this guy named Graham Spencer. And Graham said, you know, I've been to your website, and I hate it because you're advertising Green Day as punk rock. But clearly they are not a punk rock band, and you're doing a gross injustice to all the real punk rock fans out there. And, you know, I think a lot of people would ignore an email like that. And Adam writes back and says, you know, I'm not familiar with punk rock. Can you send me some demos? So Graham sends him some tapes. Adam listens, totally not his cup of tea. But you know what? Takes a couple hours, builds web pages for these punk rock bands that he doesn't even like, for a guy that he doesn't even know, and links them to his Green Day site so that if you accidentally get there, you can find real punk rock. And it seems like a waste of time, but not so fast.
Why did he do this?
It turns out, I think Adam's the kind of guy who really enjoys helping others, and you know, his goal is to figure out how he can use his time and skills to make people better off. And sometimes it comes around to help him in unexpected ways. So in this case, 5 years later, Adam ends up moving from Southern to Northern California. He doesn't know anybody. He wants to start a company, and he remembers that this guy, Graham Spencer, that he'd emailed with, who he's pretty sure is, you know, one of these stereotypical punk rock fans with a green mohawk, is possibly up in Northern California. So he emails him and says, don't know if you remember me. You know, 5 years ago I built those punk rock pages for the Green Day site, and I don't know anybody here. Would you be willing to meet up for coffee? And Graham responds, and he says, I'm still here. I'm happy to meet. They get together, and Graham says, I know a few people who might be able to help with your startup. A couple weeks later, Adam's pitching his company to about 18 venture capitalists, and one of them, set up by Graham Spencer, funds his company for $50 million.
That is amazing. That is amazing. And you see this over and over again in your book, Give and Take, that people who are just freely giving, here's this guy, he builds a website, you know, gives it to them for nothing, then builds a bunch more for something he's not even interested in. And I remember that he has some, in your book that you say that he has this sort of maxim that you should be able to give 5 minutes of your time to anyone who asks for it. And this is very antithetical to the way a lot of people think.
It is. This is one of the most powerful things that I learned from Adam. He says, look, you know, if you want to help others, you don't have to be Mother Teresa or Gandhi. And in fact, for most of us, that's a recipe for disaster. Rather, you know, if you want to be helpful, what you should try to do is specialize in these five-minute favors, where you find ways to add high value to others' lives at a low personal cost. And, you know, Adam is doing this on a daily basis. And in the Graham Spencer case, you know, I think a lot of people never would have helped this guy. But, you know, Adam said, look, it's a little bit of my time, and I think it could be not only helpful to Graham, but to all these bands that are struggling. And lo and behold, when Adam does that favor, Graham is just a college student studying computer science. But shortly before they reconnect, Graham sells a little company called Excite to the At-Home Network for $6.7 billion. And at that point, he's in a pretty good position to help Adam.
It's so amazing, and people really, as you're saying, you don't have to be Mother Teresa. You can just get in the habit of being helpful, and we'll talk a little bit about whether to do all the helpful things in one day or spread them out, but really, I mean, you feel so good if you just do little things, like if someone's going out a coffee shop door and you're 22 and pretty spry, you know, that you get up and you open the door for them, because the cost of you getting up and interrupting your reading or whatever is so much less than how that person is going to feel from that. And I think there really are great psychological benefits in the research of people doing these things.
That's certainly been my reaction as well. And I think a lot of the findings are counterintuitive and in some cases turn out to be a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, in fact, I kept reading your book thinking it should be called Counterintuitive because, and I'm talking with Adam Rifkin, Dr. Adam Grant, about Adam Rifkin right now, and his book is called Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, and it really is paradoxical, you know, how giving can be so much a way to get ahead, although you do bring out all the caveats of ways people end up being chumps. And so I want to just get a little bit into landscape, lay out the landscape of givers and takers. You said there are takers, there are givers, and there are matchers. And we kind of know what these are, but just tell us what takers are.
Yeah, so the evidence is really robust. Across industries and across cultures, there are these three styles of interaction that show up over and over again in the workplace. So the takers are the people who are always trying to get as much as possible from us. They never want to give anything back unless they absolutely have to. So, you know, typically a taker will be somebody who will claim all of the interesting and visible and important work on a project and leave, you know, the less the less critical but still necessary work for everybody else. And then you do all this grunt work, and then the taker walks away with the lion's share of the credit.
Yeah, so those are the people. That's what my dad, you know, thinks. I think that it's smart to take as much as you can get, you know, win in negotiation and everything, which actually, yes, is important. But givers, it seems, do better than takers in many, many ways. So tell us what givers are.
Givers are really the opposite of takers. Instead of being self-serving, they're trying to figure out how they can use their skills, their knowledge, their networks to benefit others. And so givers are people who, like Adam Rifkin, enjoy helping others and often do it without strings attached. A lot of people look at that and they think that being a giver is about philanthropy or volunteering, but I actually break it down into a series of behaviors that we all engage in at work. Mentoring, making introductions, sharing knowledge, teaching skills, or just being somebody who shows up early or stays late to support your colleagues.
Yeah, these things are so important. And you actually, I just remembered, I started out being an advice columnist by giving free advice on the street corner. My dad said back then, like, that's dumb, you got to make a buck. And actually, this just doing this every week was the thing that led to a column in the paper and books and everything. You have to do these things. It's very important to sort of do what you love because you love it and because you enjoy helping people. You know, the calculated, you talk about takers being calculated, they help others strategically when the benefits to them outweigh the personal cost, which is very different than givers.
That's right. Givers have a very different way of looking at cost-benefit analyses. So givers will typically say, I will help whenever the benefits to someone else outweigh the cost to me.
Right, right. And then there's matchers. What are matchers?
Well, it turns out that most of us fall somewhere in the middle of this spectrum. So we all have moments of being takers where, you know, if you think about the last time you negotiated a salary, perhaps, you were primarily thinking about what can I get. And we also have lots of moments where we think more like givers. I think that's the most common if you look at the data in mentoring roles, to say, you know, I'm just trying to make this person more successful or develop his or her skills, and I'm not really thinking about my return from this mentoring relationship. But if you look across all of our interactions at work, most of us operate as matchers. A matcher is somebody who tries to keep an even balance of give and take, quid pro quo. Amy, if I were a matcher and I did you a favor, I would expect that you would owe me an equal one back. And if you were to do me a favor, I might feel like I was in debt until I'd been able to settle the score. Very much an eye for an eye.
So givers are more like family members or friends. You do favors for your friends, and you don't really keep score the same way. Matchers behave, you know, they really are the scorekeepers.
That's right. It's almost like if you're a matcher, at least in the extreme case, you think about relationships like they're on an accounting balance sheet, and you've got to make sure that there are no credits, no debits, everything sort of zeroes out and is equal.
And you say also something distinct that happens, that when givers succeed, that it spreads and cascades. So they aren't just benefiting from this, but a lot of people are benefiting from giving, whereas matchers, it's you know, maybe more contained.
Yeah, that's right. I think what's for me really powerful about givers who succeed is that they succeed in ways that lift other people up, whereas takers often succeed by cutting others down. And, you know, I think that if you had a choice between the two and givers and takers were equally likely to succeed, it's kind of exciting to think about the idea that your success could actually be the rising tide that lifts all boats as opposed to the one that sinks all the other boats in your ocean.
Right. And actually, you give some great examples of that. A really stunning one was Frank Lloyd Wright, who was the opposite of a guy you describe in television we'll talk about, but Frank Lloyd Wright, it sounds like his success was really hampered, and of course he was successful, but it was hampered by being, well, tell us about the kind of guy he was at work.
Well, some of it is downright shocking. Frank Lloyd Wright was somebody who went out of his way to get as much credit as possible for all of the work that anyone who ever worked with him did. At one point, he actually was offended that somebody working in his office took on an independent commission, and he forbid all the architects in his office from working on separate projects and said that they would be fired and possibly even accused of forgery if they ever did any work where they didn't assign his name first, even if he had no involvement whatsoever. And you know, I think that he basically believed that the people around him were lucky to be graced by his presence. And a lot of people will say he was the greatest architect of the 20th century. Some believe he was the greatest in history. Yet, if you look at his career, there was a 9-year period where he accomplished almost nothing. And it was largely because all the apprentices who were helping to get the daily work done that was really required to be an architect had given up on him because he was such a taker. And it wasn't until he began to embrace the fact that he relied on other people that his career picked up steam again.
It's so interesting. You're right that takers see interdependence, so relying on these colleagues and apprentices, they see that as weakness, whereas you contrast Frank Lloyd Wright with this guy, George Meyer, incredible guy from The Simpsons. So tell us about George Meyer as contrasted with Frank Lloyd Wright.
Well, George Meyer is probably the funniest guy that you've never heard of. If you ask people who ever have worked on The Simpsons, every one of them will tell you that a huge part of the greatness of that show was due to George Meyer's contributions. And over a period of more than a decade, he worked on over 300 episodes, yet he's only credited as a writer on 12 of them. And George Meyer was somebody who basically looked at his role as one of trying to make the show he was part of as great as possible, rather than just trying to say, okay, how can I maximize my own fame and fortune as a writer here? And what that meant was, first of all, that George was somebody that when he had great ideas, other people weren't threatened by them. They actually saw that as value added, because here's a guy who's incredibly funny, and instead of trying to usurp our credit, he just wants to make all of our collective work better. That really, I think, gave him a chance to do more editing of people's scripts, to get his voice into the conversation more, and to take more creative license. It also meant that when The Simpsons became a movie years later, although he had already left the show, everybody wanted him involved in that movie. And I think that, you know, constantly George was somebody who was able to say, look, my goal is to try to figure out how my knowledge here can make the show as funny as possible. And if we all succeed, then credit is not zero sum, and we'll all be better off as a result of it.
Yeah, it's so, so fascinating. I am talking with Dr. Adam Grant. He's author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And one of the things that I found so interesting where you're writing about these two, Frank Lloyd Wright and George Meyer, among others, was that we privilege the lone genius who generates ideas that enthrall us, but that actually there are geniuses and genius makers, and the genius makers tend to generate more creativity, not only their own, but around them, to make the whole successful and not just their own little part successful.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful line from Liz Wiseman's book, Multipliers, where she says, look, you know, you can either try to be the smartest person in the room, or you can actually try to multiply your knowledge and skills and recognize, in fact, that the best way to achieve collective success is to bring in people who are smarter than you are. And I think that's something we see much more obviously among givers than takers. What I think is most interesting about it is there's a little bit of data that didn't make their way into the book that I think are worth mentioning here. So Nathan Ponsikoff and his colleagues track over 3,600 business units, and they just look at the frequency of giving and helping behaviors between employees. So how often are you sharing your knowledge and maybe filling gaps in workflow or stepping up to do things that might be important but not part of your job? And they find that the more often that employees are willing to give and help each other, the better those work units do on every metric you can track, from profitability to customer satisfaction to employee retention, even lower operating expenses. And these givers really manage to add a tremendous amount of value to their organizations. But as you know, there's a little bit of a paradox there because sometimes they do that at their own expense.
Yeah, and you talk about that a lot. We'll get into that. But I just wanted to get into something you talked about briefly, this thing called idiosyncrasy credits. I love this, that these are positive impressions in the minds of group members from a giver, that they get this latitude, you know, whereas if somebody brings up something that's kind of a weird out there idea, if they're a taker, that is more likely to be shot down than if it's somebody like George Meyer, who is a Mr. like, let's see the group, you know, do really well.
Yeah, this is an old idea that goes back more than half a century, and I think it's a classic. So the idea here is that when you're recognized as somebody who puts the group's interests first and takes your talents and your expertise to really try to figure out how you can make the group better off, that the group grants you then greater latitude to deviate from typical norms. And you know, that can play out in a lot of different ways, but the evidence is pretty clear that as you give repeatedly to a group or to an organization and people come to appreciate your contributions, that means you're in a position of influence to figure out how you want to shape the future direction of the group, the vision, the goals, the strategy. And it means you're able to get away with some things that a lot of other people in the group can't.
Yeah, people really trusted George Meyer on The Simpsons. They loved him. He could really have done anything. Whereas there are other people, you know, when they don't acknowledge people, one of the stunning examples of that from your book, Give and Take, is Jonas Salk. This is so shocking, where he didn't acknowledge any of his research associates on the coming up with the polio vaccine, and people were really mad, and you attribute this to something called responsibility bias. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I sat down to write about Jonas Salk as an example of a giver, and after reading extensively a great deal of biographical information, I began to believe that at least there was a pretty devastating moment of taking in his career. And I think that, you know, it's really puzzling because, you know, he's the guy who's known for eradicating polio, more or less. And there was this historic event in 1955 where he never acknowledged the key people in his lab who, without their contributions, the vaccine never would have existed in the first place. So the question is, why did he do this, especially as somebody who dedicated so much of his time and his energy to, you know, something that mattered for all of humanity? And a lot of people say, well, look, you know, he had a big ego, and he was really motivated to believe that his contributions were superior to everyone else's, and it was how he maintained his self-respect and his worth in society. And, you know, it's possible that that's part of the story, but there's this fascinating body of research by Mike Ross and colleagues about the responsibility bias, where they get married couples together. And this is really cruel, by the way, but typical of psychologists, I suppose, to, let's say we take a husband and a wife and put them in separate rooms and just say, can you estimate the total percentage of all the work that goes into the marriage that's yours versus your spouse's? And then they add up the husband and the wife's estimates, and they find that 3 out of every 4 couples add up to over 100%. So somebody's got to be lying, and of course it's always the husband. But you find this, and then the question is why? Well, what Ross and colleagues show is that ego is not the big factor. The big factor is information discrepancy, that you actually know more about your own contributions than you do your spouse's. So, you know, you remember all the times that you drove the kids to school, you walked the dog, you took out the garbage, you made dinner because you were there. Whereas it's harder to recall all the contributions your spouse made. By definition, you weren't present for all of them. And I think this is a huge part of what happened with Jonas Salk, is that, you know, he really had a clear memory of the blood and sweat and tears that he invested in creating that polio vaccine, and he simply wasn't present for a lot of the work that his colleagues did.
Yeah, and you actually have some great advice about this, you know, about how to balance our responsibility judgments versus what somebody else gave. And it involves focusing our attention on what others have contributed. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those recommendations that is logical as we think about it, but many of us don't put it into action. If we want to balance our judgments and really understand our own contributions, we have to go and seek information about what others have contributed. And that means before we assume that we're entitled to sole or majority credit on a project, we have to go and collect some really careful information about each task done by everybody around us to figure out who is perhaps deserving of shared credit.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I love this. You have a lot of practical ideas in your book, Give and Take. I'm talking with Dr. Adam Grant, and his book is Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. I really appreciate that. And you talk about perspective, how people underestimate or overestimate how people will deal with various things, from work to this very fascinating thing. You have this fascinating information about gifts when people have a registry, like for wedding presents. And now my bias is that you know, I thought, oh, it's always nice to make something, you know, like make some kind of thing for someone, do something personal, do something creative. It turns out people don't really like those, the off-registry gifts.
No, they don't. My wife and I have been talking about this for years, actually, because she's exceptionally good at coming up with unique gifts that nobody thinks to put on their registry. And, you know, my reaction to that has always been, well, they told us what they wanted. Maybe we should get them that. And it was especially funny because when we got married, she was kind of disappointed when people got things that weren't on our registry because she knew what she wanted. So it turns out there's actually research on this. Francesca Gino and Frank Flynn, two great colleagues, study this. And they track what happens when people give you a gift that's on your registry versus something unique. And you do, in fact, like what you registered for. The funny thing is, though, that despite the fact that you know this, when you're buying a gift for someone else, you still try to choose the unique one. And the problem is that you're forgetting to take the perspective of the recipient. So when you buy the gift, you're thinking about what you would like as opposed to what this person would like. And, you know, I think it's a good reminder that perspective taking is hard. And when I finished this reading through this set of studies, of course, I sat down with my wife and said, look, you know, those candlesticks that you really love to buy for people that are on no one's registries, you shouldn't give those. And it turned out that in this case, she was right. These candlesticks are just amazing. And if only anyone knew about them, they would have appeared on the registry. So
we hope, anyway. We hope. So one of my favorite chapters in your book, actually, this is my favorite title of a chapter I read in a long time, is The Power of Powerless Communication, How to Be Modest and Influence People. And, of course, we assume that the key to being persuasive is to deliver a very confident and assertive pitch. But actually, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, it's one of those assumptions that I think a lot of people hold that turns out to be only half true. And the real factor that matters here is whether you are working independently or interdependently. If you're dealing with somebody that you don't have to collaborate with over time, it makes a lot of sense to come across as confident and make sure that you're very assertive to get your way. But if you actually have to work together in a team, people tend to be off-put by that. And this is research that really actually surprised me quite a bit by Allison Forgale, who got people to work together in teams and respond to suggestions, and found that if you spoke more tentatively, if you used ums and uhs and likes and hesitations and even taglines like, you know, I think this is a good idea, but maybe it isn't. What do you think? That you actually were listened to more, because speaking tentatively signaled that you were willing to put the group's interests ahead of your own, and that meant that you were essentially a team player. So people gave you more status, they gave you more respect, they were more likely to hear your ideas and potentially follow them. Whereas, you know, the people who stood up and said, I think that's a terrible idea, or we have to do this my way, were eventually really rooted out of the central sort of influence conversations in their teams. And I think that's a good reminder that there's value in sometimes admitting that we don't have all the answers.
Yeah, it's so interesting because you can see how those statements, those direct sort of pushy statements, would make people instantly defensive. And I love how you write this in the book. You say there's value in vulnerability, and there are two stories I love. One is about you. Another one is about this lawyer. He's this young lawyer and, you know, on this case, and he was all nervous, and he was a stutterer. And you think that maybe this helped him win the case.
Yeah, this is a story about Dave Walton, who was trying one of his first major cases. It was a trade secrets case. And Dave, for most of his life, has had a stutter. It's something that he's gotten better at managing over time, but it rarely disappears entirely. And he was often told that it would be a major liability, it would signal that he lacked confidence, that it would, you know, make him a target, perhaps, of criticism. And he was in this huge case. Afterward, the jurors came up to him and they said, look, you know, we voted for you, and he won the case. And they said, we just wanted to say we admired your courage, and we noticed your stutter, and we think it was really great. And what is this all about? Well, stuttering, the signal of essentially being a little hesitant or a little bit tentative, is a way, first of all, that Dave communicated that he was a regular guy, he's likable, and secondly, it makes him a little bit vulnerable. He's not telling the jurors what to think necessarily. He's rather standing up there and presenting a case. He has some pretty compelling facts. He has a powerful story, but he's also human. And it made him come across as very authentic and natural, and the jurors, I think, as a result, liked him and trusted him more.
So fascinating. And you point out that takers tend to worry that revealing weaknesses will compromise their dominance and their authority, but you actually used this to your advantage. You were a very young professor. You're presenting to 23 colonels in the U.S. Air Force. They're all these fighter pilots, you know, the macho of the macho. And so instead of going in there all blustery, what did you do?
Well, I would like to say that I had this insight at the very beginning, but what I first did was, you know, I knew that these wing commanders who shortly after my session went on to become 1- and 2-star generals, I knew that I had to do something to convince them that I knew what I was talking about as, you know, a 25-year-old kid speaking to people twice my age who had a ton of experience. And I went in and talked about my credentials very confidently, and it was not effective. And actually, it was worse than that. I think that the thing that I remember most was one of the Air Force colonels writing that there was more knowledge in the audience than on the podium. And yeah, that was somebody who had pulled his punches. The feedback was pretty tough.
Oh no, but that was the first time you presented, and you went back and you did something different.
I did. So I realized at that point that, you know, I was trying to establish my authority instead of making a connection with the audience. So I went in and said, look, I'm going to be a little bit less confident. Instead of trying to come across as powerful and dominant, I'm going to open with a more powerless and hesitant approach. So I just said, look, you know, I know some of you guys have read my bio. I used to perform as a magician. So I'd like to perform a little bit of a mind reading trick right now. And I'd like you to just think about the first thought you had when you walked into the room, and then I'm going to try to read your thought. And they all looked at me like I was insane. And then I said, okay, it's pretty clear what some of you are thinking right now. What can I possibly learn from a professor who's 12 years old? And it was quiet, dead quiet. And then everybody started to laugh. And one of the colonels said, no, that's way off base. You got to be at least 13. And, you know, afterward, the feedback was much more positive. I basically gave the same presentation, but I had built a connection with them. And I think I made myself vulnerable. I called out the elephant in the room and I said, look, I know you guys have a lot more experience, and I want to try to bring you some evidence that might give you some new ideas for how to lead more effectively. And they seemed to really take to that much more than they had my first approach.
It's just great. I love one of these comments. I can't believe Adam is only 12. He did a great job. This is great. And now you do express throughout your book, Give and Take, you express caveats. And one here you say is that expressing vulnerability is only effective if the audience receives other signals establishing a speaker's confidence. So, you know, you're a PhD coming from a good school. So it wasn't like you're a guy from off the street who decided to talk about this at random. So maybe that helped, you know, to fill in the other side.
Yeah, I think it definitely helped. I think, you know, I'm always reminded of Abraham Lincoln here. Lincoln was in a debate, and his opponent called him two-faced. And Lincoln had this really brilliant response. He said, you call me two-faced. Do you really think if I had another face, I would choose to wear this one? And,
that's,
you know,
great.
I think it was a great example of an effective way to be vulnerable, because he's self-deprecating in a domain that's completely unrelated to his competence. And, you know, by making a joke about his appearance, he's humanizing himself to the audience without calling into question whether he's a trustworthy and capable leader.
That's great. I your book made me see that all my flaws as a speaker, I thought, well, maybe they make people like me better instead of just making them think I'm not very professional.
I think that happens more often than we believe.
I like that. And so I didn't have you define this up at the front end when we started talking about this. What is powerless communication?
Well, I think actually powerless communication for me is an umbrella label for a lot of what we've been talking about for the past few minutes. It's, you know, saying, look, I'm willing to speak vulnerably as opposed to, you know, necessarily lead with all of my strengths and capabilities. It's saying I will perhaps be willing to open up about my weaknesses, about my areas of uncertainty. It's about saying I don't always have all the answers. I'm willing to ask for advice. And it's asking questions as opposed to just telling people what the right conclusions are.
Yeah, the asking questions, you get into that on what works in sales, how important that is, that givers, by asking questions and getting to their customers' interests, they build trust, they gain knowledge. And you give an example. You did a study on this of people who sell eyeglasses and what distinguished the stars from the rest of the pack. And there was one guy who made you really want to buy a pair of glasses. So what was his approach?
Well, what he did was when I walked in this mystery shopper role, he just started asking me questions. Why are you here? What kind of glasses are you looking for? What's your taste? And it was very clear that he wasn't trying to sell me anything. He was really trying to learn about my needs to figure out if there was a reason that I ought to be making a purchase. And, you know, it made him instantly likable and endearing. And when I looked at the broader pattern in our data, I found that, in general, the givers tended to start out behind because they were reluctant to deliver these very pushy, aggressive pitches. And sometimes they lost sales because of it, whereas the takers were going to walk in smugly, tell you exactly what you needed, and make sure that you walked away with a purchase. But over time, because the givers asked a lot more questions, they learned more about your needs and interests. When they did give a pitch, it was actually tailored to those needs and interests. And then the givers attracted a lot more repeat business, also a lot more referrals. So even though the average giver might be behind by about 6% in quarter one of a sales cycle, by the end of the year, we find that givers are about 68% more productive in annual revenue than takers and matchers.
So interesting. And you talk about one way to separate, you know, if you're looking, who's a swindler, who's a Samaritan in selling, you know, if you're on the other side, if you're buying, is to look at who's a giver like this. Like this guy, you quoted the eyeglass guy. He said, "My mindset is not to sell. My job is to help. My main purpose is to educate and inform patients on what's important. And my true concern in the long run is the patient can see." And so this is a guy you want to go back to. But, you know, takers can fool us. So talk about ways to avoid getting fooled by a taker who just wants to make you think maybe they know the tricks and they're trying to make you think they're a giver.
Yeah, a lot of takers are good fakers. And one of the ways that you can catch them is to look for a pattern that I call kissing up, kicking down. Takers know that they need to create an aura of generosity when dealing with powerful people. But if you've never tried, it turns out to be a lot of work to fake caring about others in all of your interactions. Which means that when takers are dealing with peers and subordinates, they tend to let their guard down a little bit. And people who work laterally to them or below them get to see more of their true colors. One implication then is not to trust a boss for references, but to think about, okay, can I get some feedback on this person who, you know, from people who are not considered powerful or influential? A second way that I really enjoy spotting takers is when you're learning about their success, pay less attention to their successes and their mistakes and more attention to how they explain them. There's evidence that takers talk about their successes more by using I's and me's as opposed to us's and we's. And when you get to the domain of failure, of course, that flips. And then they're willing to blame their failures on everybody else as opposed to taking personal responsibility for the errors that they've made.
Oh, I was going to ask you about one other fascinating thing you talk about. And I'm talking with Dr. Adam Grant, author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success, a book I love because he's a wonderful writer. In addition to laying out the research, they're great stories. There's something called lekking in the animal kingdom. It's L-E-K-K-I-N-G. It's how animals show off their desirability as mates. And you give the example that CEOs who were takers, they had a different size picture in their annual report. It was really interesting.
Yeah, this is one of my all-time favorite studies. Chatterjee and Hambrick go and get Wall Street analysts to rate the CEOs of over 100 computer companies on this taker scale. They're rating how egotistical, narcissistic, self-absorbed, self-serving these CEOs are. And then they look for clues that correlate with those ratings that you could pick up without ever meeting the CEO. And sure enough, the CEOs who are rated as takers by those analysts who know them actually have more prominent photographs of themselves in their company's annual reports. They have larger pictures, they're more likely to be photographed alone, and it sends a pretty clear signal. I'm the most important person in this company. It's all about me.
It's so fascinating. And another thing I just wanted to emphasize, you touched on this a little bit, but that reputation via network is so important for figuring out whether somebody's a faker and if they're a taker in disguise. And we are really into what's called moralistic punishment. We want to punish takers. We will even pay to do it. So people, if you talk to people about who, you know, what's somebody like, if they've been a taker, I think people are, they're intent on letting you know that.
This is one of the biggest roles that matchers play in this whole system. So there's this term that I really love that I could not resist using in the book called pro-noia.
I love
which
that.
Is I think it's a term that everybody should have in their vocabulary. So it's sort of the opposite of paranoia. So if, you know, if paranoia is the fear that other people are out to get you, pro-noia is the fear that other people are out to help you. And a lot of times givers sort of carry around this feeling, right? They feel like there's somebody out there trying to support me. I don't know why. And in this case, it's not a delusion. If you're a giver, that actually is your reality. There are people who are out to help you and who are plotting your well-being, and they're called matchers. Matchers, as I mentioned earlier, believe in fairness and justice. And there's nothing a matcher hates more than seeing a taker act selfishly and get away with it. So if you're a matcher, you might feel like it's your mission in life when you encounter a taker to punish the heck out of that person so that justice is served. And that, you know, that form of altruistic or moralistic punishment is one of the most powerful ways, actually, that matchers go about protecting the givers around them from being exploited by takers.
I love that. It's so, so fascinating to work on that. And now this sort of relates to how givers can pay a productivity price. There are different prices they pay, one that they can get screwed by takers, but they can also pay in their productivity. But a thing that you point out so interesting is that the solution seems to be giving more. Explain.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a mystery to me too. Well, there are a couple of different ways to make sense of it, but let me start with a simple observation. Look at a study of engineering. This is Frank Flynn's research looking at how many favors you do for your colleagues versus how many you get back in return. And when you track the data, the least productive engineers are the ones who do more favors than they get back. It seems like they're so busy helping their friends and their colleagues that they just run out of time and energy to get their own work done. But then there's an interesting twist, because the highest productivity doesn't belong to the engineers who trade favors equally, like matchers. It also doesn't belong to the engineers who get more favors than they give, like takers. The most productive engineers are actually the ones who also do more favors than they get, the givers again. And this plays out in several different domains where the good guys are more likely to finish last, but they're also more likely to finish first. And how frequently they give is a big driver of the difference, because the people who essentially give more than they get but do it sparingly, they never benefit from the relationship and reputational rewards that come from giving. The people who give often are able to build deeper and broader connections. The matchers go around and gossip positively about them, spreading the word about how generous and helpful they are. They attract a lot of reciprocity from matchers, too, who are really motivated to pay it back when givers help them out. And so if they give frequently, they actually end up building these powerful connections and developing reputations that allow them to get new business, to get promoted. And the other thing that happens, which I think is to where your question was going, is that people who give more frequently actually gain energy from it. It becomes a source of meaning and purpose at work. You feel like your actions really made a difference. Whereas, again, if you do so infrequently, you never really feel like you're doing work that matters.
Now, there are a couple questions that relate to this. One I want to ask you about was, there was a school teacher who was just burned out from giving, and she, for her also, the answer was giving more. So explain that too, because these nuances are fascinating.
Well, so in this case, we're talking about Conrie Callahan, who is teaching through Teach for America at a high school that was ruled one of the most dangerous in the country. Conrie was completely burned out, waking up 6 a.m., often grading papers until 1 a.m., receiving very little positive feedback from her students, who were sometimes arrested for bringing guns to school, in other cases, just completely unruly. So Conrie is at the height of burnout. She starts a little nonprofit called Minds Matter, where she brings a group of people together to tutor high-potential but low-income students. And she gives up almost her entire Saturday every week doing that, so she's giving a lot more. And all of a sudden, her burnout begins to fade. Well, what happens there is don't burn out because of the amount that they give, within reason. They burn out when they give without feeling that they're making a difference and having an impact. The struggle that Connery is facing is at school every day, she's dealing with a lot of kids who don't show up, a lot of kids who are not interested in education. She feels like she's not able to actually help anyone. She goes over to Minds Matter, increases her giving, but also focuses it on a group that really cares about learning and that's going to make serious strides based on the contributions that she brings. And all of a sudden, she feels like the knowledge I have is useful, it's valuable, and I can make a difference. That then gives her energy to take back to school, because after working with these high-potential kids who are highly motivated to learn, she has renewed hope that as part of her regular job, even though it's hard, she might be able to make a dent.
Wow, this is such amazing stuff. It's so important. People really need to take this to their workplaces. Show the people who work for them that they matter. I mean, for people in their lives, too. You know, if your husband, your wife is unappreciated, they're not going to feel good about helping you and doing things for you. It's just a sort of a bottomless hole. And your book really lays that out well about, you know, perception of making an impact is so important. You said it even serves as a buffer against stress.
It does, yeah. Beth Campbell and I collected data on high school teachers, and we found that those who had very stressful jobs were more likely to be burned out and emotionally exhausted, unless that they felt that their jobs were truly making a difference, in which case they were able to take a look at that stress and say, yes, my job is challenging, it's difficult, but there's a justification for it, and it's all worth it because I'm able to help a lot of students learn in a very significant and lasting way.
And I want to get into pathological altruism, but one more topic that relates to what we're talking about giving and spacing out your giving. You write about the research of Sonia Lubomirsky, who I've had on the show a number of times, and she had this assignment doing 5 random acts of kindness a week. So some people did them all in one day. Others sprinkled them across 5 days. So tell us about the finding. Who was happier?
Well, most people guessed wrong on this, and I did too. The assumption is that when you do one random act of kindness every day, you'll be happier and more energized than if you just pick, let's say, Tuesdays every week to do all 5 acts. But Sonia's research supports the opposite, that you only get happier, you only get a boost in your energy if you chunk all 5 of your random acts of kindness together in one day each week. So if you do one act a day, it doesn't really matter for your mood. This is still a new line of research, but I think Sonia's explanations are pretty convincing. So one factor here is that when you give a little bit every day, it just feels like a drop in the bucket. Whereas when you take a day to do 5 acts of helping others, they add up to something meaningful, and you feel like, I did make a difference today. I think the other piece of it is it's a little bit distracting to spread your giving across your week. And sometimes that may get in the way of other goals and ambitions you have, perhaps for getting your own work done, where if you pick one day and block out time to do those 5 random acts of kindness, it's a lot easier to focus then on your own work the rest of the week.
I've read her research on this, but I think, you know, just as what I was saying before, that if you're not doing this project, if you get in the habit of helping, if that's your orientation, like these people like Adam Rifkin, for example, who is a person who just all day long looks to help people, then I think that that would really have an effect, a positive effect, the same way that chunking does, because you're not doing it as an assignment. It sort of becomes who you are, this helping person who's always looking. It's that orientation of looking to help instead of just, I'm going to go on my way and do my taking.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
So getting on to pathological altruism, I love this. First, let's backtrack. I want to say, you know, that you write about 2 types of givers and that they have dramatically different success rates. And this sounds good to people, selfless givers, being selflessly giving, but this is not good.
No, it, at least in the long run, is not the most effective strategy. If you break down giving, there are really 2 kinds of givers that exist. They're the selfless, and then there's another group that I call the otherish.
I love that name.
Maybe a word that never should have been invented. But
I like it.
Otherishness for me is about saying, I'm going to help others as often as I can and not expect anything back from them. but I'm also going to keep my own interests in the rearview mirror and make sure that I don't overextend myself. It's a little bit like being on an airplane and being told to secure your oxygen mask before coming to the assistance of others.
Exactly.
Selfless givers don't do that. They end up putting other people first so often and to such an extreme that they do sacrifice their energy. They also put themselves at risk for being taken advantage of by takers. Successful givers in the long run are much better at saying, look, I can't help all the people all the time with all the requests, so I'm going to be a specialist instead of a generalist. I'm going to focus on helping particular people, either certain groups or individuals I care about, or givers and matchers, and be a little more cautious with takers. I'm going to chunk my giving into particular windows and block out time to get my own work done separately. And I'm going to focus on one or two ways of giving that I excel at and enjoy, and really try to crowd out the rest of the giving because I don't feel that I'm going to have a unique impact there. I was just going to say the thing that really struck me about this is, a lot of people will say the selfless givers are more altruistic because they're doing it for the most pure reasons. Yet, if you look at the data, the otherish givers actually give more because they protect their energy and their resources. So in the long run, the givers who give with self-interest in mind end up giving more and ironically might be more altruistic.
Yeah, and I've read Oakley's work on this too, and she talks about how a lot of times people have narcissistic goals without really understanding that they're doing something because it feels better for them at the time, but maybe it's not the best for the other person. And what you're talking about is, I would call it judicious giving, which is the opposite of what she calls pathological altruism. You print the definition and you say it's an unhealthy focus on others to the detriment of one's own needs. And I think that airplane oxygen mask example is really excellent, and it's just sort of false to pretend that you don't need anything and you're just going to be Mother Teresa, who actually, of course, per Christopher Hitchens, wasn't a very good person anyway. So she's always the example. We reach for that, and I think, oh, you shouldn't have done that. you talk about volunteering. This is so important because I love these things in your book, Give and Take, and I'm talking with Adam Grant, author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. You give these practical examples of things people can do. And you say volunteering is shown to be a substantive way to be happier. I think this is maybe from Sonia Lubomirsky's research. But you say that research shows that if people just do 2 hours of volunteering a week, that their happiness and satisfaction and self-esteem are up a year later.
Yeah, these are data I've had a lot of fun reading through, in part because it really fits nicely into this idea of sort of combining the five-minute favor with the notion of chunking your giving. So when people volunteer, they get to choose a cause that's meaningful to them. They get to focus on giving in a window that's convenient for them. And it doesn't take an enormous commitment of time to feel like you're making a difference. And volunteering has all these other ancillary benefits of allowing you to connect with new people, to learn new skills, and to sort of step outside of your normal areas of expertise and focus. So it's one of those things where I think a lot of people hold back from volunteering because they think, gosh, I just don't have the time or energy. But when you track the data and find out that adding just 2 hours a week of volunteering not only boosts happiness, but in several studies has actually increased longevity, then it seems like a pretty worthwhile commitment.
It is so fascinating, and there's so many areas in your book I want to get to, and we don't have time for all of them, but I wanted to talk about recognizing potential in other people, giving to other people in that way, and there's a remarkable study you write about. It's this classic study by Harvard psychologist Robert Rosenthal, where they tested elementary school kids. The results were shared with teachers. 20% had shown the potential for what they call intellectual blooming. They show these unusual intellectual gains over the course of the school year, and sure enough, those kids did improve, but what was the trick of the test?
The trick was that the teachers think that certain students are bloomers or spurters, and they've shown objective signs that they're going to improve, but actually those students are chosen at random. The study is designed to figure out what would happen when teachers believe that certain students have the potential to bloom. And guess what? When teachers believe that students are bloomers, those students bloom. Teachers' beliefs can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the way that I tie this to give and take is to say that one of the things we see consistently among successful givers is they start out seeing everyone as a bloomer. They assume that the people who they're teaching in their classrooms, the employees that they hire in the workplace, are people with a lot of talent and a lot of motivation and are capable of getting better. By holding them to high expectations, challenging them, looking for ways that failures and mistakes can be learning opportunities, they actually increase the likelihood that these people do, in fact, bloom. Whereas takers and matchers are much more likely to either be skeptical of the potential of the people they work with or say, look, I'm going to only invest after I've seen signs of brilliance from this person.
One of the examples I love was that these very successful musicians the thing they had in common wasn't really this great raw talent, but that they had had these piano teachers who believed in them and rewarded them when they were very young, when they were just starting out. And it's so amazing to see that instead of it being, you know, this idea that, you know, oh, you're a genius, you sat down at the keys and we just knew.
This was something I would not have expected. Reading Benjamin Bloom's research on this, that if you look at Olympic athletes, mathematicians who have become world class, concert pianists, in each of those cases, it was very rare that the people who became the very best in music, science, or sports were stars early in their careers. But rather, they were the ones who had teachers and early coaches who made learning fun and practice fun, who went out of their way to try to make this experience as enjoyable as possible, which is, of course, something that a giver would look to do, right? To say, look, I'm not just going to be a slave driver. I'm going to try to figure out how to create an experience where kids want to come back. And I think what happens is when you have a coach or a teacher early on who's a real giver, you take a stronger interest in that activity. And that motivates you then to engage in the deliberate practice, the gritty, tenacious focus and perseverance that we all know is necessary for achieving true mastery.
My favorite example of that is this old, fat, white accounting teacher who quotes Usher and CeeLo Green in class. You know, the students laugh about the old white guy doing it. But, you know, they really get into the fact that he's into motivating them, interesting them, and he puts out all these star students who maybe wouldn't be stars otherwise.
CJ Skender is one of the most inspiring people I've ever met. And it's pretty rare to find an accounting professor that people will line up to sit in his class at 8 a.m., but the great thing about CJ is he says, look, you know, accounting is a language. And like any other language, I need to translate it so people can relate to it. So he'll open every class with a quote from a song or a movie and see if anybody can guess it and toss out candy to them. And it's a way of just engaging them in the classroom and helping them feel like, hey, this guy is actually interested in everything, not just in accounting. And that really creates opportunities then for him to tie some of the principles he wants to teach from accounting to, you know, ideas from pop culture that they might already be familiar with. And it's certainly had a colossal impact on the students who have gone through that classroom, many of whom come out believing that they can do things that they did not expect to be possible.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I love reading that chapter. I'm talking with Dr. Adam Grant. He's the author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. And you have the greatest chapter titles. I love these. Chump Change, Overcoming the Doormat Effect. And this is very important because, as you point out, many of us think we can judge givers and takers well, but we're wrong. You say there's a lot of noise, and a psychological trait called agreeableness really throws us off.
Yeah, this is a trap that I've fallen in more times than I can count. So there's this personality trait called agreeableness. On the high end, agreeable people tend to be warm and friendly and nice and polite and welcoming. On the low end, if you're more disagreeable, your instinct is to be skeptical and challenging and critical. Most of us stereotype agreeable people as givers and disagreeable people as takers. But there's a huge difference between agreeableness, disagreeableness, which is your outer veneer, and giving and taking, which is your inner motives. So there are lots of agreeable givers and disagreeable takers, but we forget the other two combinations. One of those being the disagreeable givers, in my view, the most undervalued people in organizations. They might be rough or gruff or tough, but ultimately have your best interests at heart. And they're the people who are willing to ask tough questions, who challenge the status quo, who make sure that ideas that may be popular but not entirely compelling are revisited. The group that really ends up getting us in a lot of trouble, though, is that fourth category, the agreeable takers. Those are the fakers. You know, those are the people who are extremely nice to your face when they want something from you and then are perfectly comfortable stabbing you in the back. And I think we all need to remember that there's a huge difference between being nice and caring about other people and being helpful to them. And next time you come across somebody who's incredibly warm and nice, you might recognize that that could be a facade to disguise a more self-serving set of intentions.
You actually have some great advice on this, and it's that instead of contemplating a person's feelings, and you got into that a little bit, you say it helps to consider what they're thinking, to maybe discern whether they're this agreeable taker.
One of the easiest ways to do that is to say, look, okay, when I empathize with someone, I'm going to be motivated to give. And I may want to check that impulse if I don't know what this person's history or reputation is. So one of my favorite lines of questioning is to ask people, okay, you know, what would you do in a situation like, and then, you know, fill in the blank. The problem with asking a question like that is that nobody is willing to admit, hey, I'm a taker, in a direct conversation. Yeah. But you can shift the question a little bit. And instead of asking, what would you do in this situation, throw out a scenario and ask them what they think other people would do. And lo and behold, people tend to project their own motivations onto others, which means that in revealing what they think others will do, they're also telling you a little bit about their own motivation. To make this concrete, let's take an example from integrity test research. Assume that, Amy, you wanted to figure out if somebody applying for a job working with you is going to be a thief or not. One of the best questions from all of integrity test research is to ask, what percent of employees do you think steal at least $10 worth of merchandise from their employers every year? So let's play that out. What would you guess?
15%.
15%. Okay, great. So obviously we can't do this with one question alone. We need multiple questions, but just to bring this one to life. What happens is most people answer that question by consulting their own behavior. And a typical taker will say, well, all right, let's see. I stole $372 worth of merchandise last week. I'm guessing it's pretty common. 96% of people have got to steal at least $10 per year from their companies. Whereas the givers start to think, gee, $10 a year? How do you even steal that little? Who would steal a pen from their employer? What kind of person does that? And the data actually do show the higher your estimate that other people are thieves, the greater the odds that you yourself are a thief.
Well, I'm glad I said 15%.
No, yeah, you're in really good shape there.
Oh, good.
Otherwise,
good.
I would have had to change the example. But
right.
No, it is interesting that we extrapolate from our own behavior when trying to predict other people's behavior. And so I think this is probably an overlooked way of gaining a little bit of insight into people's tendencies.
Okay, so we are out of time, and Greg is sending me messages about that on Skype, but I just want to get from you just some final, you know, your final words to leave us with on giving.
Well, I think looking across all the data and the examples, I'm going to take this back to Adam Rifkin's five-minute favor and say, as you think about doing more five-minute favors, we've covered a couple of principles for how to do those effectively. One would be to chunk them into one day each week or one core window, as opposed to spreading them out. A second would be to really make sure they align with your interests and your expertise. Because if you end up giving in all different kinds of ways, it can be pretty exhausting and quite distracting. Whereas if you give in ways that are perfectly aligned with your skill set and with what you find to be pretty enjoyable and fun, then it can become much more energizing and efficient. And over time, what you'll discover is the population of requests will shift toward alignment with what you prefer. So if you take Adam Rifkin, Adam is the king of introductions. He was named Fortune's Best Networker in 2011. And one of the ways that's happened is he, for the past 10 years, has made 3 introductions every day.
Wow.
Now, it takes him 5 minutes or less to make a good introduction between two people who could benefit from knowing each other. He absolutely loves doing it. He just gets intrinsic joy out of seeing people connect. What happens is then, over time, as Adam becomes known as a connector, people stop bothering him with other kinds of requests. They don't ask him to read their business plans, because why would you go to Adam for business plan advice? Yeah, he's a successful entrepreneur. He's started 3 companies. He's done very well in his life. But what he does best is introduce people, and so that's the unique contribution that you want to go to him for. And I think that that's ultimately what happens to successful givers, is they develop a reputation for 1 or 2 key ways of giving, and that becomes sort of their bread and butter.
Thanks. This is so great. Adam, this has been a wonderful show. I've been talking with Dr. Adam Grant. He is author of Give and Take, A Revolutionary Approach to Success. This is just so wonderful because it's so substantive. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
There's nothing like the thrill of a last-second victory. That buzzer beater from 20 feet out. The game-winning field goal that just makes it as the clock ticks down. That great limited-time deal on a new 2017 Volkswagen at the Volkswagen Model Year-End Event. We need to make room for the 2018s, so this could be your last chance to get a great deal on select 2017 Volkswagen models. Visit your nearest Volkswagen dealer for a test drive today. But hurry, because the clock is ticking and we can't call time out. There's nothing like the thrill of a last-second victory. That buzzer beater from 20 feet out. The game-winning field goal that just makes it as the clock ticks down. That great limited-time deal on a new 2017 Volkswagen at the Volkswagen Model Year-End Event. We need to make room for the 2018s, so this could be your last chance to get a great deal on select 2017 Volkswagen models. Visit your nearest Volkswagen dealer for a test drive today. But hurry, because the clock is ticking and we can't call time out.